Hello, this is Jesse Liberty, and this is yet another podcast. Today, I have John Pompa and Dan Wallin. John is a Microsoft RD, an incredibly successful Pluralsight author, one of the kindest people I have met, a buddy, a friend, a coworker from Microsoft. Dan is one of the cooler guys that you're going to meet, incredibly knowledgeable, Microsoft RD, also a Pluralsight author, incredibly successful at that, and founder of Wallin Consulting. Gentlemen, I am really happy to have you here. How are you?
Doing great. Well,
what I'm hoping we can focus on are all things Angular and anything related to that and anything else that is of interest to you. But I know, for example, John, you just released a new Pluralsight course on Angular and Breeze. And Dan, you have Angular in 60-ish minutes on YouTube and a flipbook on Angular and all sorts of interest in this topic.
That's right. Yeah.
And I got to start, even though it's not Angular focused, very briefly, when to create that flipbook, what are you doing? Is that a tremendous amount of work?
To create the flipbook's easy. There's a little program you sign up with Flipboard. To get the content in there, of course, it's not hard to get it in, but it takes time to curate it all. So, yeah, I waste several hours a week.
You invest several hours.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Thank you. Waste would be how my wife would put it. But, yeah, I invest several hours a week non-business time doing it, because it's fun for me. I like doing it.
I'm trying to learn enough Angular to be able to read that profitably. So let's start very briefly with what Angular is and what role it plays. And specifically, it seemed like for a year or two, all the cool kids were doing jQuery. And all of a sudden, they're all doing Angular. And I know they're not mutually exclusive, but on the other hand, it does seem like much of what people were doing with jQuery has been replaced by Angular, and Angular has a very different concept of how to do things.
Well, I think a good place to start is a step even further back than that or higher up. And you bring up a great point on jQuery and Angular. And think about, why were people excited about these things, or are people excited about these? And I think the answer to that is more that people are trying to solve the problem of, how do I create a more user-friendly, performant, and scalable application that can work in web-based devices, especially now that the web-based devices have expanded to multiple types of devices and users these days. So, and I think jQuery was the first incarnation where most of us got comfortable saying, we can build for all these different devices and multiple browsers, and jQuery will handle the disparate nature of all of them for us. And then Angular, to me, is the next evolution of that takes it even much further.
Yeah, I'd agree. I think the big difference, and this is the big mental shift people have to do, is jQuery, of course, is all about the DOM. And Angular is, although you can manipulate the DOM with it using things like directives, it's all about really the data. And, it's not a new thing, actually. Some people have done this in other frameworks where you have this data binding, but it's definitely a big mental shift as people switch from jQuery over. Now, I want to kind of emphasize, I still know a ton of companies doing a ton of jQuery as well. So it's not like jQuery is dead by any means. But I think people that are doing really heavy data-driven apps are realizing that, hey, maybe this data binding thing, maybe there's something to it. If I have to write less code and make it more maintainable and all that fun stuff. And Angular, it offers that.
Right. It seems, from the outside looking in, and just correct me, but it seems like the two huge calling cards of Angular that trump, to some degree, jQuery are data binding, and that you're not doing direct DOM manipulation, but instead you're using directives. Do I have that right?
Those are two of them. And there's a lot of big calling cards. I think, what made jQuery popular, for example, besides the multiple browser thing, is how easy it was to write one line of jQuery in your app. You could pull jQuery in and just use one line and say, I don't really need to know jQuery, but I can use this one little bit. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think Angular's biggest calling card, and I think this is more of an opinion and I'll give you mine, but getting started with Angular to do the basic Hello World app is dead simple. It's really, really simple. And if you watch Dan's 60 minutes-ish video on YouTube, it shows how easy it is to get going with Angular. But then I think the next level of that, where people struggle with something like Angular, where they didn't so much with jQuery, is, yeah, we can create really, really dead simple apps with Angular, like in 5 minutes, literally. But then to get to that real world type of app, there is a big gulf between hello world demo and let's make an app that's a little bit more scalable. So there's a lot of aspects of Angular that people need to learn. I think that's the hurdle a lot of people are going through right now. And the good news is it's not an insurmountable hurdle, and it's actually quite fun. I think a lot of people really enjoy it, the programming style of Angular. But getting going with these things, jQuery is one of those things you can have like one or two lines of code and you're happy and it works. Whereas Angular is more, it's kind of a, you're changing the style of the way you're actually developing your app.
Okay, and is Hot Towel an attempt at helping people kickstart that next higher level?
Yeah, and that's all it really is. I mean, people say, well, why'd you open an open source project called Hot Towel? I said, well, honestly, it's, if I had a better way of doing it, I would have. My goal with Hot Towel was simply to have a way to say, every time I start an Angular project, I need some CSS, I need a menu, I need layout, I'm going to need views, I want to have routing so I can go from page to page, and then the structure for our apps, which we all have personal opinions on, you know, where do you put your controllers and your views and your services, things like that. Just give me a starting place for all this so I don't have a blank canvas. So it doesn't actually add a whole lot. It just takes a lot of the best of breed. It grabs an Angular core and animate and routing. It pulls in Bootstrap for the CSS, and it just puts them all together for you. So you don't have to spend that half hour to an hour or maybe days to get going.
I think you're underselling, because it does everything you said. It also provides examples of how to do many of the things you're going to need to do. And it provides some guidance on emerging best practices. So I personally think it's hard to imagine for me starting an Angular project without Hot Towel, at least at this point in my understanding of Angular.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I think what I've told people to do is say, well, should I keep updating Hot Towel? Because it's a NuGet package, and I'm actually developing a Bower package for it as well, which is actually a little more challenging to some degree. Not the technology, but the way it's delivered.
Mm-hmm.
But I actually tell people, no, you probably don't want to keep updating Hot Towel. It's really a starting point. So NuGet is not the ideal vehicle to deliver that, because NuGet packages generally people want to keep updating them. But what I'm trying to do is say, pull in the NuGet package for Hot Towel. It'll pull in all this other stuff for you, and then update the individual technologies as they go. For example, once Angular hits version 1.2 full release, which should be any second these days, you know, I would update that one.
Mm-hmm. Now, the only concern that I did want to ask you about with Hot Towel, and I don't know that you're going to change this at all, is that I note that you use Bootstrap 2 rather than Bootstrap 3, which is convenient because it makes creating the spans easier. But it was just an interesting decision. Is that just where your comfort was?
No, it was a very painful decision, to be honest with you. So I actually wrote the app with Bootstrap 3, and I have a version of that works with it. But one of the problems we have is, and this is that emerging world. So we can say, and I'll take a quick detour on this because it'll help answer it. In Angular, it's mostly one framework that you pull in and you can rely upon. And I think a lot of us like that. But it's not 100% of everything. So there's a couple libraries we'd like to pull in, like Bootstrap. Well, to really use Bootstrap well with Angular, you've got to pull in this list of directives called UI Bootstrap, or Bootstrap UI, whatever it's called. And when you pull that in, the problem is that library, as of 2 or 3 days ago when I last looked at it, was still not fully compliant with Bootstrap 3. They're moving towards that, but it's not 100% compliant with it. So what I had to do is decide, if I want to use Bootstrap 3, I'd have to use kind of partially unstable directives to make the two work together, or avoid the ones that didn't work well and, you know, maybe code around the ones that I really wanted. Or I could just use Bootstrap 2 for now, which those are very solid with. And then once UI Bootstrap's directives kind of get more formalized and stable, then I'm going to migrate that all over to Bootstrap 3. Does that make sense?
It does. The other thing I wanted to ask you about, both of you about, is when you're starting an Angular app, whether or not you're using Hot Towel, do you tend to do that in Visual Studio? And if so, do you bring in any aspects of ASP.NET, or is it standalone and there's no need for that?
I think it really depends on what you're building. So for me, no, I don't actually start with anything. It only takes 5 minutes or so to pull in the assets I need and create the folder structure. So I actually don't. I mean, there's a lot out there. There's Hot Towel, there's Yeoman. If you want to go, you know, kind of in maybe using Sublime or Brackets or one of those editors. The other thing is, I'm not on Windows. I'm always using Visual Studio, but on Mac I use Sublime Text.
Yep.
So there's not really an option there for that. I think the big benefit of things like Yeoman and Hot Tile is kind of what you said that you mentioned earlier, Jesse, that might be underselling it. Because a lot of people, they just don't get how the pieces fit together. And I'll include myself when I first started doing Angular back in the day, which, you know, was like not that long ago because it's really new. But it was really hard to know, you know, when you talk about factories and services, well, what folder should that go in and those types of things and how do they all interact? And that's the challenging piece of it. And that's where I think Hot Tile or Yeoman or whatever you want to use kind of helps people jumpstart it. For me, once you understand the pieces, well, then you can do a little more what you want because you know how you want to organize it and, you know, your experience builds up there.
Okay. And John, your latest Plural Site course is specifically about using Angular with Breeze. What does Breeze bring that Angular doesn't have? And what alternatives are there to Breeze for that role?
So that's a great question. And I highly recommend people to start an Angular app without Breeze first, to specifically try to tackle the app and see where they get with it. The biggest place that I found a need for Breeze after I started an app, and actually the first one I did with it with Breeze was with Durandal, which is another framework. I got so far down the road of building my app, and the first real need I had for something else was I wanted to share the data across multiple views. I didn't want to go get a list of people, like a Jesse Liberty was a person object I had. And he might be on four different screens, and maybe he's not the main thing on all the screens. Maybe he's just a sub-object in an object graph. I don't want to have to just keep going and getting that data on every page. If I already have you, I wanted to just know about it. Well, Breeze lets you know that information and cache it across the pages, which is huge, especially when you're updating data. So then when I update Jesse's first name to Sally, then all of a sudden Sally's everywhere as opposed to me having to try to figure out how do I sync up all this data. So as you get to really rich data problems, and Breeze does so much more, as you get to all this kind of stuff, having something like Breeze in your app just makes your life a ton easier. While you can code that in Angular, that's a ton of code, and I've written it. It's just thousands of lines of code to synchronize all this stuff, and it's not worth it.
And is Breeze, am I right, it's both client-side and server-side, or do you use it principally for one or the other?
So luckily, recently, just like within the last couple of weeks, there are now different packages for NuGet or downloadable packages where you can download Breeze just for the client and also a Breeze server-side package. And they have Breeze server-side packages for ASP.NET Web API, for the mean stack, for Ruby. They've got all this kind of stuff that you can do for the back end. So there's all these different back ends that you can use. My happy path that I like most often is usually Web API and Entity Framework on the back end, but it's and it works really well with those. But to say Breeze is both sides is not entirely accurate because you could just use the client-side Breeze stuff and then wire up your own back-end services to talk to it.
Yes, my goal, my secret, not-so-secret goal is to wire up Breeze and Angular with Service Stack and to create something that uses that combination rather than Web API and EF just to be able to show that alternative. But what I understand from the experts, Reed, Ward, Bell, is that that's going to be non-trivial, at least right now.
Yeah, and the biggest kick with most of those things, and there's two to point out. One is that Breeze can rely on iQueryable on the back end. Mm-hmm. If you don't need iQueryable, you know, for all like the OData type stuff, then you don't need, then you don't have to worry about it. You can make specific endpoints. But the real big thing is Breeze on the client relies on metadata that comes from the server. It can glean that metadata from Entity Framework very easily, so you have to do nothing. If you're not using Entity Framework in the back end, like you want to use Service Stack with your own data layer, your own custom data layer, then to really get the most out of Breeze, you're going to have to provide that metadata yourself in some kind of a web service on the back end. And that's the kind of thing that Ward Bell has been helping people do, and he recently did it with the Mean Stack, and he's done it with the Ruby Stack.
So Dan, when did you start working with Angular, and is it becoming a principal technology for you?
Yeah, so I around the first of the year is when I started jumping into it really heavy, and then I'd say by March I started, you know, building some things with it. I was kind of more on a slow, gradual learning path, and yeah, around March I hit it pretty heavy, and then, you know, that YouTube video you mentioned, and it's had some good hits there to help people jump. You know, it just jump starts. It's just only about 60, 70 minutes or so. So nowadays, yeah, I agree with what John said earlier. He said something about it's fun. And I really think it is. Once you get the hang of how modules work and factories and directives, and yeah, there's a lot of pieces, but once you get how those pieces work together, it's really nice. For those that are interested, I was going to say to kind of compare and contrast in a fairly simple app. I have one up on GitHub that we can probably have, I'll give you a link, Jesse, you can put out there after for the show. But
great.
It has two options on the back end. You can either use native, the HTTP provided by Angular, or you can flip one little switch and you can switch it over. It'll use Breeze. It also on the server side has web API, or you can use Node.js and Mongo on the server side. So it's kind of a try to do it all app, but it's not so big that people that are new to this won't be able to get it. It's called Customer Manager. So I'll get you a link. We can put that up, but it'll help people kind of see the difference between those options John mentioned.
Absolutely. Let's dive a little deeper into Angular on the assumption that folks have taken a look at it. And one of the questions that came up for me early on is that there are a number of ways to create, and I think the word I want is services, one of which is services, and another is factory, and another is provider. And can you help disentangle some of that?
Yeah,
it's a mess.
Yeah, it is a mess. It's hard to understand, but it's easy once you know. So there's actually five. You can configure things. You can assign kind of name value pairs called values. You can do providers, like you mentioned. You can do services. You can do factories. So in a nutshell, there is no major difference between services, factories, providers. You literally could pick what you like. The difference is in how the object is returned from them. So what I mean by that is I prefer factories. And the reason I prefer factories is with a factory, inside of your factory function, you create an object, add on some functions to it, you know, whatever it does, maybe it has some properties, whatever that is. And then you return that custom object out of the factory. And that's what a factory is. So factory is kind of like custom object. A service, the function itself for the service, that is the object. So you don't go inside of that function and create a kind of like a child custom object. You just say this dot, you know, foo equals some function and this dot foo equals some function. So you use the this keyword a lot more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's more about how you, yeah, it's about how you code the app. And Dan, correct me if I'm wrong here, because I also prefer factories, but I think the reason you and I probably are drawn to factories over services is not for what they can do for you, but because we both prefer the revealing module pattern.
Yeah. Because you can get your own object. Yep.
Wait. Say more about the pattern and what it is and how it relates to factories.
So yes. Inside of a factory, you've got this object you can return with got methods and properties or whatever members on it. Basically, inside the factory object, you create the exposed set of things that you want that object to do, like order a product or save a customer or first name and last name if they're properties. You define what you want those exposed things to are, and then you reveal those. That's what the revealing part is. And that's a pattern that Dan and I have been doing for a couple of years in JavaScript. And it's very pop. It's not like we invented it. This thing's been around for years. And I think it just helps us, you know, again, speaking for Dan slightly here, it helps us kind of just put our heads around what we're doing inside of JavaScript as opposed to using this keyword over extensively.
Yeah. If you like control over your own objects, you'll probably like factories better than services is really what it boils down to. The third one, providers, I actually don't really use providers except for one scenario. So providers can do the same thing, but they have to have a special get type of method in them that it's kind of almost like they have to have like an interface they adhere to. The big difference, though, is if you ever want to inject one of those in to, for instance, a configuration section where typically you configure your routes and things for your AngularJS SPA there, a configuration section won't take services or factories, but it will take a provider. So there are some kind of fringe cases where provider might be preferred. But in general, I'm with John. I like factories. I call everything a service.
Me too.
Factory. Because I get tired of dealing with the names. Because, you know, what do you call a web service? A RESTful service. You know, everybody calls it a service. So
it's a thing that does a service for you. Yeah. And the factory just creates the service.
And so I just call it all services. Sounds like John does too. But that's the main differences. It's just in how you create the object.
Yep.
One of the things that I noticed is that you can do a certain amount of work without a server. And then even though you're not actually getting data from the server, you suddenly need IIS or a Node.js server or some kind of server. And what's that about? What is Angular using that for?
Well, out of the box, you technically don't have to, because you could use something like Azure Mobile Services to store the data. You know, that's not a web server per se, or what's that other one? Firebase. So I think it really depends on your app. I think a lot of people, if you want to persist the data back with the HTTP object or Breeze, then yeah, you're going to be using the mean stack which is, you know, Node and Mongo and stuff like that. Or if you're doing a web API, you'll, you know, probably have Unity framework and all that fun stuff on the back end. So out of the box, Angular doesn't have any requirements on a server side stack at all. And I think that's also a reason it's pretty attractive, is you're not locked down. You know, it doesn't matter if you're purely open source or if you like more of the stuff that, I don't know, Oracle was doing or Microsoft was doing or whatever. You can use it with any of those as long as they're kind of a RESTful type service.
Yeah, well, let me push back on that. I'm not talking data here. I'm not talking persistence. But it seems like you need a web server, IIS or something equivalent, in order for your Angular application to run, at least under some conditions.
Well, I mean, if you want to get the scripts and things out to anybody, then yeah, you'd have to have a web server. But at that point, a static web server literally could work in that case. You wouldn't even have to have a specialized app type of server at all. Angular, though, on its own, until you start getting into Ajax calls, and then it will, that's the case on anything, though, because of cross-domain calls. But Angular on its own, I mean, you could just load it off the file system and play with it if you want. But yeah, as soon as you start interacting with behind-the-scenes things, you're going to want to have at least a static server to serve up your scripts and things for your...
Okay, let me push you just a little more. What do you mean by behind-the-scenes, and what do you mean by a static server?
So static server meaning a server that just serves up your CSS, your JavaScript, and your HTML.
Okay.
Views. Behind the scenes meaning your RESTful services.
Okay.
Your data services. Yeah.
Yeah. For example, let's say you try to run an Angular app, a very simple Hello World Angular app on a file system, mm-hmm. no web server. You might be successful in that right out of the gates until, as Dan mentioned, you try to do something like an HTTP call because the file system itself is not a web server, so the browser cannot reconcile effectively that it's not a cross-domain call, and the browser will prevent you from doing some of those. Right. Another very common thing is once you add in two or three or four views, you know, you get routing and navigation in your app. Those are actually calls as well, and the browser tries to reconcile those and figure out what's going on to get the templates to load them. Basically, any time the browser needs to talk to the back end, forget Angular, but the browser needs to talk to the back end for anything. If it's not coming from the same web domain, you have to deal with this whole cross-origin requests, and yep. that's when you need a web server to be able to help handle that.
Great. And that raises my next question, which is the existence of JSONP, which is to allow you to make requests across domains. And what's involved in generating JSON? I mean, obviously, retrieving JSONP is very easy, but what's involved in generating JSONP data?
Now your server has to have a special little piece of code, in essence. All JSONP is it returns your data is wrapped in a function.
Mm-hmm.
So for web API, for instance, I didn't write it. Rick Strahl actually wrote it, good friend of mine, and John knows him as well. Rick wrote a really cool little attribute you can put right above your web API controller, and it'll auto-convert your data into a wrapped JavaScript function. And that string gets returned, and then whether it's Angular, jQuery, whatever it is, it kind of unpacks that and then it calls that function, and the function then returns the data to you. So JSONP is really, might possibly be one of the hackiest things ever invented, but it works really well. Cores is where things are going nowadays, and hopefully soon we won't have to rely on, you know, JSONP as much, but I'll let John chime in on that.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I mean, cores is where people are heading for a cross-origin request. I forget what the S stands for.
No doubt service.
Something or other. How about that? So basically, that allows you to go from a cross-origin request. But JSONP, there's also concerns out there that because you're basically wrapping anything inside of a function, that you could execute malicious code as well. So there are some places where JSONP is not preferred because of that. And technically, JSONP, all you're doing is you're taking your JSON, your object, and wrapping it into functions. So in that sense, it's not malicious. But if you're executing, if you're allowing someone to execute a function, you don't know, and you don't know what that's in that function, that's where the concern comes in at times. And I think that's another reason why, because it's a hack and it got around some limitations, I think it's another reason why cores is becoming so much more popular.
For sure. I mean, if John had a function, would you trust it, Jesse?
Good point. Very good point. Let me dive a little further into Hotel. I know that you rely in Hotel on Bootstrap, and certainly we're seeing Bootstrap being used for a lot of starter apps and not such starter apps. Is the contribution that's made by Bootstrap in Hot Towel, does that allow you also to go to something like Bootswatch and pick up a theme and plug that in as well?
Absolutely. So in Hot Towel Angular, which is a flavor for Angular and a flavor for Durandal, another framework that's out there, I basically use Bootstrap. And in the one for Angular, I use a theme from Bootswatch or Wrap Bootstrap or whatever that site is. And we'll get you the link to the site.
Mm-hmm.
But you can swap those anytime you want. And I highly recommend people do that. They go up to a site like Wrap Bootstrap and they get their own template and then modify and tweak it to the way they want to. And you can purchase these if you don't have a designer in-house. Otherwise, you get what a friend of ours, Sean Wildermuth, calls the bootstrapification of the web, where everybody's site looks like the default Bootstrap site.
Those themes, it's worth mentioning, if you're using them one time for one application, are incredibly inexpensive.
The price of a cup of coffee, literally.
Right. You know? Where they get expensive is when you want to distribute the theme, such as you have to do for Hot Towel or Pluralsight.
Right, which is why the one I picked for Hot Towel cost me $30 to distribute. So
yes, as opposed to some of them, which are $5,000.
Yes, like the one you ran into, Jesse.
Did you hear this story, Dan? I picked out this this theme that I wanted to use for one of my courses, and then talking with John and Sean and others, I realized I needed the distribution license, which was $800. And I was going to pop for the $800, which was going to kill me. And before I could, he raised it to 5,000, and that made the decision easy.
Oh man, $5,000.
$5,000, yeah.
Yeah, that would definitely make the decision easy.
Yeah, I was willing to give $30 my own money up to help people out, but that would not $5,000.
Yeah, $5,000's a bit much.
So, John, you mentioned Durandal, and there are a couple frameworks like Durandal that do pretty much what Angular does. So why Angular?
So a lot of it is taste, to be honest with you. And I do a whole presentation on why do you pick Ember versus Durandal versus Angular versus React versus roll your own. And I break everything down into two categories. There's the technical reasons to use one over the other, which everybody focuses on. And then there's what I call the cool side of the pillow effect. It's what makes you feel all warm and fuzzy inside. And one of the biggest reasons I think people pick Angular, quite honestly, is because they feel from Google. There's two things. One is from Google, and Google has got a whole team behind it, and therefore it's much more secure and stable. Now, whether that means it is more secure and stable, who knows? But I think we'd all agree that if given the choice between that and product X that may not have a team like Google behind it, that, yeah, we'd probably agree that that probably is more stable. And then we can't technically prove it, that it's more stable or not, or measure it, but we feel it is. The second thing that people come up with a lot with Angular is the concept that it's less moving parts. And this one I feel is kind of a cross between technical and comfort. There are less external factors that come into play, meaning you don't have to pull in five or six other libraries. But Angular itself does allow you to extend it to pull in other libraries if you need to. But out of the box, it comes with a set of files, its modules, that lets you get going quickly, that you don't have to rely on, you know, five other different libraries to get you going. And those two things alone are probably the biggest reason people are flocking to Angular over some of the other frameworks out there.
And do we have any numbers that say that people are flocking to Angular, that that's where people are going, or is it just an impression? Because it certainly is my impression that Angular is taking off.
No, there actually are. I'm trying to remember. I have it bookmarked. Let me see if I can find it real fast. There's actually a site out there you can get some stats off of called Topsy.
Okay. We'll put a link.
I'll send you the link. But here's one I'm looking at right now that just kind of shows the path. And all it does is just measuring tweets. So that obviously doesn't necessarily mean that somebody's adopting it. But going back to what John was saying, let me chime in there. My number one reason for choosing Angular, because there's Backbone, there's Ember. At the time, Backbone was the most popular when I started looking into this. Ember wasn't to 1.0 yet. In fact, it just hit that milestone fairly recently. It was kind of along the lines of what John said. I've just never been a big fan of pulling in a ton of third-party libraries because I worry about just moving forward. You know, if you never change your scripts, fine. But at some point moving forward, you're probably going to upgrade at least one or two of those scripts. And I think the more scripts you have, the more hassle that could potentially present in the future. Whereas Angular was kind of one script, one core script that provides everything from, you know, data binding to dependency injection to unit testing to Ajax features, all that stuff. And I think it kind of, I know for some of the companies that we're working with on this and the training we do with them, they really feel, how'd you say it, John? Warm and fuzzy or something like that?
Yeah, it makes them feel better. And can you prove, I mean, I know you can't and I can't either. Can you prove that because it's with Google and it's one thing that it's better? No, but I tend to lean there too.
Yeah, it just feels more, I don't know, stable, if you will. You know, whether or not that's reality or not, it doesn't really matter. Just a lot of companies are now looking out for that reason. I think the other
side of that too, Dan, is that, and let's just throw some water on that for a sec, because I mean, I agree with you, but the devil's advocate side of that is we know that large companies never dump products that they start putting money into, right?
Right.
Like Silverlight or Google Buzz or Google Twitter or
never.
So we're not Google. Saying it's never going away. Don't come to Dan and I when something happens, you know, 10 years from now. But
yes, thank you for bringing that up. And everyone that's listening to this will have a place where you can sign to make sure you understand that.
I don't think the worry is 10 years from now, but I do think the worry is 1 or 2 years from now, because
days from now.
Right. Things have been happening very, very fast in the JavaScript world. And, you know, nobody's leaving the dance with the framework they came with.
That's an interesting picture you just put in my head, Jesse.
There you go.
While we're on the topic real quick, the other big thing that for me that was a big kind of deciding factor is if you do Backbone or Ember, there's some extra plumbing involved with some of the objects. It's not really just POJOs, plain old JavaScript objects. Right now, Angular uses a whole digest cycle under the covers where it detects dirty changes. And it's just a totally different way of doing it than some of the observables, you know, like Knockout as an example, because Knockout's really nice. Now, that will change, though, I can just about guarantee, mainly because I've seen Brian Ford did a post recently. The big change coming to JavaScript, or, well, one of the, you know, million, is observables. So I think once that makes it in, it's pretty standard across all the main browsers. Angular will certainly change over to have built-in observability of properties. But right now, it's really cool because you could just write a standard old, you know, like an object literal, assign it to something, and it just magically works. You don't have to wrap it and extend it or do some of these other frameworks. And that was another big thing for me I liked.
It is a big thing. And as you mentioned, you know, in the future, even though JavaScript's going in that direction, I highly doubt that Angular would change the model, meaning you'd still be able to use POJOs, but still get that new the same functionality.
Yeah, I think under the covers, they'll just kind of hide it away.
Where POJO is plain old JavaScript object.
Yeah.
And then the other side of it is, you know, Knockout uses this observer pattern, which for .NETers is kind of like the iNotify property change interface. And it's a pattern that's been around for years, and they've been using it in JavaScript, and Knockout relies on that. But Durandal, which uses Knockout for its data binding, actually has a plugin for ES5 compliant browsers to allow it to use POJO now. So you can actually use POJO with Durandal or with Angular to basically get the benefits out of it in modern browsers. Now, the big advantage there is Angular, even if you're not using modern browser, like if you're using IE8 or you're stuck there, you can still use POJO. But with Durandal, because it's relying upon these ES5 property getters and setters, you have to use the plugin that the Durandal folks have created.
Before we get too deep in the mud, let me change direction slightly and ask you about testing. The Angular website makes a very big deal about testing and how Angular was built with testing in mind and with testing all along. And the testing that they're doing is with Jasmine and with Karma. Are either of you doing extensive Jasmine and do you use Karma?
That's what I did just today. And the Karma didn't feel super positive today, though.
Nope, it didn't.
It didn't work what I wanted. So my Karma was not good for whatever reason. Yeah, it is. It's as they advertise. It's very testable. I'm not going to say it's the easiest thing people have ever done for real life apps. If you're doing simple, like you have a calculator app, yeah, unit testing is like dead simple. But as soon as you start hitting real services and they start hitting other backend services and factories and all this fun stuff, you know, they have some really nice objects you can use, like HTTP backend is one. You can kind of fake your Ajax calls. Breeze, you can do it as well, by the way. I actually just had a conversation. That's what I was on with Ward earlier, trying to figure something out for Breeze. And it works very well, but it also is a bit of a learning curve. And I don't know if John, if you agree there, but that's what I found.
Which parts of the learning curve, Jasmine or Karma or both?
No, those are just tools. Writing your unit tests and learning how to inject in the proper dependencies is the tricky part.
Okay.
Yeah, the syntax of Jasmine's not that hard. I mean, I think QUnit is dead simple unit testing. Jasmine is not that much harder. But as Dan said, it's not just using Jasmine to write your unit test. I mean, writing a unit test for a calculator that does addition is simple, which is what most of their samples show.
Yep.
It's when you want to start mocking and stubbing and pulling stuff in and asynchronous tests, that gets a lot more complicated to deal with.
All right. Let me start with the simple, which is Karma requires, if I understand it properly, requires Node.js and a configuration file. Is that a fairly straightforward thing to do?
That's easy. That one you could just say, once you do npm install Karma, that's easy if you know a little bit of Node. Then you could just, at a minimum, you could do Karma init, and that'll generate the Karma file. You mentioned the config file. The file itself is actually pretty straightforward. There are several options you can add, but most of those are optional. So yeah, I mean, Karma, for those, maybe let me back up just a little. For those that don't know much about Karma, what it is in a nutshell is just a kind of a unit test wrapper. It's not a framework for unit testing, as in it doesn't force you to use Jasmine or QUnit or one of those. What it does provide is a way to, as you save, for instance, a test, it can sit there and monitor your files and automatically run all your unit tests. So it kind of makes for a more productive workflow, is what I would say, when you're building unit tests. Getting it going is actually pretty straightforward. The tricky part, I think, is, as John was and I were just saying, is it's not even the Jasmine. It's just knowing the specifics of Angular and how to inject in your proper things. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think this is the one place that Angular actually fights against itself, to be honest with you. So I'll be the average developer here and think one of the biggest reasons Dan and I both said we love Angular is that when you get involved with it, it's really just, it does most what you want out of the box. You learn the Angular structure and the way you code things and you're ready to go. When you get into the testing side of Angular, you know, we're throwing out other terms already, you know, like Node and Karma and Jasmine and Sign-On and all this other stuff. So now you have to learn with the testing side of it, a bunch of different pieces you have to put together to get the testing going. Is it hard? Not really, but it's more stuff. So you do, to me, the learning curve to do testing properly with Angular is much higher than the learning curve to actually using Angular.
Absolutely. I would agree. In fact, I will leave this person unnamed, but they made a comment a while back that, wow, this is way harder than writing the actual code.
Yeah.
Speaking of the unit test versus the actual code. So
Angular is fairly big. So without going into detail, can you run off some of the areas that we haven't even touched upon yet?
So Dan, why don't you start with kind of the stuff that you start with in your 60 minutes-ish video? Because I think you've got a good list of 5 to 10 things in there that are great to start with.
So where I always tell people to start, and this is let the pieces, and John, just chime in if you want instead of a walkie-talkie approach here. But number one, learn the basics, the basic directives. Okay, and I know you mentioned those a little bit, but in a nutshell, for those coming from the jQuery world, they're not the same, but I kind of think of jQuery directives as similar to Angular directives to being similar to jQuery plugins. Now, they're not, but they are in a way, because what directives do is they manipulate HTML, and what jQuery plugins do is they manipulate HTML. It's just a totally different technique than how they're used, and there's the whole data binding that jQuery doesn't offer. So I think once you learn some of the primitive directives, such as ng-repeat, ng-init is good for sample data. A lot of people don't know about that one, but it's just a really simple way to initialize fake data without having to learn all the other stuff. Then you can just get a really simple HTML page kind of up and running. Like John said, getting the Hello World thing going is a piece of cake. All right, then you're going to say, well, I don't want to keep all that code, you know, hard-coded in the page. So then you'll move it out to a controller. And then you'll bind the view to the controller. But then you'll say, well, but multiple controllers need this data. So then you might refactor that out into maybe a factory. Then you're like, okay, this is great. I have a little more of an architecture here. But now I want to call a backend service. I don't want to hard code the data in the factory. And then you got to know about the, you know, HTTP components or Breeze, or there's a resource you can use and some other things. So for me, what it really boils down to is you got to know the directives. Got to know how to associate a controller with your views, and that's really simple to do. But then where people really fall flat, and I'll let you chime in for the rest here, John, is then you get into modules and routing and some of these other pieces. And so I'll tag you. You're in now, John.
Cool. Yeah. And I agree with all that. I mean, and specifically some places to start are some of the more common directives people use, and things like ng model and ng controller and ng repeat, as Dan mentioned, ng app, which is the one I always forget when I start an app, and you know right away because the app won't actually run. So, you know, Jesse and I did that the other day for a good, I don't know, I'm going to say it was 5 minutes. It was probably 5 seconds, but it felt like 5 minutes of what did I do wrong? And, you know, little things like that. And the other thing I do a lot is more just when I first started Angular, my biggest struggle was knowing what questions to ask. So one of the first things I do now is when I'm trying to write an app and I'm not comfortable in a certain area of Angular, I open up the docs and I go right over to the list in the API of all the directives, and they're listed alphabetically. And again, we get that list linked to Jesse if we need. What's nice is sometimes you're doing something, you're like, geez, you know, I'll pull out a contrived example. I would like to have some code that automatically captured the keystrokes as somebody's typing it in a filter. You know, so you could write something like that with jQuery and then wrap it up in your own directive, or if you'd like to. But odds are one of those probably already exists, something common scenarios like that inside of Angular. So if you can go look at that list of directives, a lot of times that'll trigger something in your head going, oh, geez, I could do that here instead of using jQuery to do that. And that helped me early on because you're not going to memorize all 60, I'm making up a number here, directives that there are. You'll memorize the common ones that are out there. And then the second piece of it is a lot of people are trying to, I'd say, shoehorn in a lot of jQuery into Angular. And I've been victim of this too. So one of the first things I do, and I just answered this from a good colleague of mine at Dan's the other day, he said, you know, I've got a bunch of jQuery code and let's pretend I just can't get rid of it. The client has said I need to keep this code and it's really complicated. What would you do in an Angular app? I said, well, the first thing I would do if I couldn't get rid of it is I'd take that code, put it in a separate file, and wrap it in a directive. At least then I don't have to look at the jQuery and deal with it, and then it's reusable such that when I can finally get to getting rid of the jQuery, I don't have to change my implementation of it. I just use that directive. Exactly. So understanding how to split your app apart, it's more complicated. And Dan, you mentioned modules and routing and all that, and I think of that as definitely being more complicated. But I think you start at the control, the directives, you start at the simple concepts, and then you just think about things as pieces that fit into your puzzle.
Yeah, it's like building Legos. You know, if you don't have the manual, it's pretty hard. So I'd highly recommend, as John mentioned, get comfortable with where the Angular docs are. I know when I first started, I wasn't even sure which page to go to for the proper docs, because back in the day, they were a little more, I don't know, in flux, I'll say nicely. Once you figure those out, it'll help you a ton. Without those, yeah, you kind of feel like, all right, let's turn to Google or Bing again.
One thing I'd really like to point out, and to plug Dan a little bit on this too, is there are so many places you can go to find out what is Angular. And to be honest with you, there's a difference between awareness and learning. And the thing I really like about Dan's 60 minutes, I can't even pronounce it, Dan, 60 minutes, 60-ish minutes
video.
Yeah, something like that. And Dan will provide you a YouTube link. Is that it's, yeah, there's some learning in it, but I think more importantly, he provides an awareness of what the heck is it and why would you want to use it? So in that video, you're not just diving into the syntax. You're actually understanding a little bit of what is this and why would I even want to bother with it? Which I think too often in our industry, we forget. We just go to the newest,
coolest
thing.
Yes, and we'll definitely
put
a link to that. But you said in passing that one of the things that some folks stumble on is modules. And I'm not sure whether modules are the difficulty or the dependency injection that comes with modules, the list of dependencies and then creating the functions. And at least at first glance, there's a certain amount of saying the same thing twice throughout Angular. So, for example, you declare a module with all the dependency functions or dependency, what do I want to say, services, and then in your function, you declare them again. Do you follow what I'm saying?
No, I know exactly what you're saying. What's going on there is to avoid minification problems of your scripts. And going back to modules, though, I do agree with you. Defining a module is actually really easy. You just say angular.module, give it a name, give it some dependencies. Where people, I think, really get confused is the injection piece. And I think you're right there because, you know, for instance, when you do module, whatever you called it, .config, and you go to configure routes, you have to have this route provider, this dollar route provider. And I know for me, the first time I saw that, you look at it as sample and you go, okay, well, where did that come from? Or if you want to use, for instance, Ajax calls, you want to do the HTTP one, you'll put $HTTP And again, you'll see this like in a factory up in the function definition that's associated with the module, and you'll go, okay, where'd the HTTP come from? And so there's a little bit of just
magic.
I was trying to think of a clever way to say it. Magic sums it up pretty well. That's why I said get good at the docs, because those different objects are in the API docs. Once you know, because the name really, really matters. And that's why you'll see things duplicated. You know, you'll see in quotes, something like $HTTP. And then in the function, you'll see again, $HTTP. And the first time you see that, you're going, what the heck? Why do I do this? And it's not even new. I mean, Require.js and some others, they kind of do this thing too. All it's doing, you don't have to do it, but you should. Because if you're minifying your code, what it will do is make sure that the name sticks and that the minifier doesn't change $HTTP to H or something. Because that would break Angular. That would break Angular.
Yeah, and the minifier will still change at the H, as Dan says, but by having the string in there of $HTTP, that stays the same in its pure state so that it looks up the service by the string in Angular by $HTTP, and then it says, okay, take that thing, and now it's represented by H or Y or whatever the heck the minifier turns it into.
Yep. Yeah, and that's another tricky thing is you got to make sure your things are in the proper order. I might have found
yes.
that out.
Yeah, I've never made that mistake.
Yeah, because if you do your string things, I think you're referring to, Jesse, and you get these string things, you know, are different order than the function takes. Yeah, that's a little bit of a problem.
It's a good point here. This is an opportunity for tooling to really help us down the road. And I know that like Sublime and WebStorm and Visual Studio, that's great places that they could help us down the road is, you know, reconciling. Look, you've got these things. They appear to be in the wrong order. Or there's even grunt scripts that are out there, you know, grunt tasks that you can run in your code to say, oops, you forgot to minify, protect your module. So there's ways you can protect yourself against it so you don't make that mistake or you don't have to worry about it. But right now, to me, that's the biggest area of need. And I think we're going to see change over the next year or so is the tooling for these JavaScript development frameworks is really poor at this point compared to where I think
it'll
it's going
nice to be. It'll be nice to have a hint or a lint for Angular.
Yeah.
Yes, beyond just IntelliSense, which is pretty much all we have right now.
Yeah. It's really easy to shoot yourself in the foot. And John mentioned something as simple as ng-app. And I can't even tell you how many times I start a little simple app just to maybe I'm prototyping something. And I'm like, man, why is this not working? And then, you know, feels like a long time later, even though it might have only been 60 seconds. But you're like, oh, geez,
yeah. ng-app. You do once an app. You know, you write one time in one app. And if you write 20 apps a year, that's not a lot of repetition for you to remember, oh, geez, I got to put ng-app in there. So easy to forget.
Very. See, I agree. I think the tools will help a lot down the road. Because right now, I mean, I think, tools like Yeoman are very helpful, I think, for people to start if that's the route they want to go. I think once you kind of are comfortable and you already have some of these config scripts like for Karma or Grunt already available and you can just make a few quick tweaks, then, you know, for me, I kind of prefer to just, I don't know, have full control. But the tool's getting better. I mean, there's not a lot of tools out there right now, but it's getting around.
Yeah, and two things I'd like to mention that we can add links to as well, and I think Dan and I are going to send you a bunch of links, Jesse.
Great, that'd be great.
Is one is on NuGet and Bower. One thing I'm not a fan of is the AngularJS package that's on NuGet actually gets something like 100 files. It gets all the internationalization files. It gets all the minified, the maps, the full-blown debug files for every module. And it's just a mess. So if you just want to get started with Angular and you just pull that NuGet package down, you're going to have 100 files in your scripts folder. So one thing I did recently with a couple of fellows is just we created a Angular package for each of the modules. So if you just want the core Angular, you're just going to get that file. If you want the routing, you're just going to get that file. So for getting started, there's a mental barrier that people have when they see 100 files in a folder. And that can help them.
Yes.
The second thing is little tools. Like Dan's got some live snippets he runs. I think they're called snippets these days. Little templates to get you going with controllers and things. And I use Sidewaffle, which is an open source project, which allows me to add new files that kind of lay out my pattern for doing controllers and factories. And I encourage people to create their own and contribute to these open source projects because NuGet, Sidewaffle, all this stuff, Bower, you can contribute and it really helps the community out.
And Sidewaffle you can get through NuGet and its Visual Studio extension.
It's actually its own Visual Studio extension, and you can go to sidewaffle.com to check it out. And it's got templates for Angular, the Randall, JavaScript, and a bunch of other things.
Great.
And what's that new one, John, you're working on? Minty Zebra Fresh or something like that?
Minty Zebra Waffles.js.
I hope that's not real. Is that real?
No, it's not. It was in a post. Dan's making fun of my post on JavaScript soup, which, because we always joke about how it seems like you take a adjective, a noun, and a verb, and you put them together, and it makes a new JavaScript library.
Minty Zebra Waffle. That's that, the
best. That's up there with Magic Unicorn Edition. That's excellent.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Before I let you go, there's a lot of information on the net. There's Pluralsight courses. There are some books. Tell me about conferences for folks who are interested in Angular. And I know that's a bit of a setup because you're both involved with the Angle Brackets conference. So maybe you could start there.
Yeah. So John and I both kind of head up together with some other great people. Some of the talks that'll be for what we call Angle Brackets, which is kind of more just really anything related to the web. It could be HTML, JavaScript, CSS, those types of things, HTML5, things along those lines. And the goal there is to provide something that when you come to like the Angle Brackets conference, as an example, that instead of one focus topic on, you know, whatever technology X, that you can actually get exposed to everything from Ruby to Node to client side frameworks like Angular, Ember, and others, and just kind of have a really flexible framework there, a little more open, almost like a code camp in a way, but with some really, really, you know, we handpicked these speakers from pretty much all over the world. This last one, John will chime in here, we had Douglas Crockford as an example, and some really, you know, experts in their field, which is pretty cool to have.
I hear tremendous things about Angle Brackets, and you run it concurrently with another conference. Is that always or just sometimes?
Currently, it's always. It's a Dev Intersection. Basically, it's a very good conference on ASP.NET and Visual Studio and some other technologies that are Microsoft-centric. But the thing Dan and I liked about the Angle Brackets is it's kind of like a Mix shoot-off, which used to be a conference called Mix, which was a mixture of web technologies. So our goal with Angle Brackets is to bring this whole other angle, pun intended there, of web technologies that may or may not be related to Microsoft. They could be Google. They could be Facebook. They could be, you know, mom and pop shop. Basically to bring another angle and option to people, just let them basically open their eyes out to what else is out there.